on Ozan. The Heart and Holiness of God, entitled, I Have Called My Son Out of Egypt. Our theme for this morning's class is not at all unrelated to the topic that we were considering yesterday. We might feel, in retrospect, that the topic we stressed yesterday seems rather negative. Understanding the various descriptions in the prophecy concerning their waywardness, trying to understand what the prophet means, what the Old Testament means by apostasy, trying to appreciate the enormity of Israel's sin, the extent to which, in the apostle's words, sin abounded. And towards the end of yesterday's class, we began to take a look at the way the prophet anticipates the doctrine in Romans, from which we quoted our title, that grace has also abounded and is in fact quite capable of stretching well beyond the borders of the abounding sin. Now we take that thread this morning and bring it through the prophet and examine the graciousness of the Lord's call to his son, whom he knows is in Egypt, whom he knows, even though they are now in Israel at the time of Hosea, has really, figuratively speaking, returned to Egypt with all of its idolatry. So the Lord's grace should be apparent to us. And as we consider these great examples of God's patience and love, we need to consider all the time the extent to which we, individually, are in need of his grace as well, and the extent to which his grace should give us a pattern as to how we as disciples should deal with one another when we perceive that there are weaknesses in the ecclesia and that there is an erring sheep. The attitude of God towards the sinner has to be our attitude in working with the weak and the wayward. We commence by recalling that beautiful statement in Romans 5 and verse 20, that where sin has abounded, grace has much more abounded. And the word in the original means, grace has immeasurably exceeded the abounding sin. Now we certainly should by now be struck with the enormity of Israel's sin. In fact, Isaiah, the contemporary prophet with Hosea, aptly describes what Hosea has now described to us thus far. Says Isaiah, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool. What Hosea saw was the same as what Isaiah saw. And if we've never appreciated the background of Hosea's times before, we can now see that that is the background against which we place Isaiah's proclamation and assurance. The nation's sins were like scarlet and were like crimson when Isaiah exhorts Israel to that return and to the offer of comfort. According to Hosea's revelation, we can see how red and crimson-like was the apostasy of a nation. Really, we can see that the apostasy had affected every aspect of society in Israel. The politics, the rule of the kings, the example of the burning oven yesterday, describing graphically the sins of the people and their willingness to consume in their sins even their very rulers and their priesthood. Bloodshed and oppression were rampant in Israel. Sin was the common currency of Israel's sick society. And apostasy fouled the very wellsprings of the nation. And to borrow from the New Testament again, we can see from the expression in Corinthians used by God to Paul, was in fact God's grace sufficient for the Apostle Paul, who called himself chief of sinners? Paul says it was. He understood that by revelation through Jesus Christ when he asked for the thorn to be removed three times.
My grace, Paul, is sufficient for you, even though you are weak and call yourself the chief of sinners. So was God's grace sufficient to cover the abysmal ignorance and sin in the days of Hosea? Of course it was. Could he forgive Israel, considering all of this? Would he forgive Israel, considering the prophet's declarations? Of course, God could and would. We will see that as he now appeals to a deeper extent to Hosea and his people through the prophet. Have you and I really grasped the extent of that gracious offer spoken of by Paul, reiterated by God through the Apostle Paul when he speaks to the Corinthians about the thorn in the flesh and God's strength being made perfect in human weakness? We have to first of all grasp the enormity of our own sins in order to appreciate the enormity of God's grace. And the more aware we are, as Hosea was trying to help Israel, the more aware we are of our own sins, the more we are able to appreciate the extent of God's grace. So both of those thoughts overlap in Hosea, the identification of their sins and the assurance of God's grace. The more they appreciated their sins and weakness, the more they would be humbled and appreciative of God's offer of grace and forgiveness. We have to perceive with God an abhorrence of what is wrong. It says of Christ, quoting from the Old Testament in Hebrews, that he loved righteousness and he hated iniquity. We hear a lot about the importance of loving righteousness. But is that commensurate in our own life with an equal abhorrence for what God hates? How much do we hate what he hates? How much do we love what he loves? A lovely thought that relates to all that was revealed to Hosea. By looking at three figures now in the prophecy to Hosea, we can find illustrated for us in graphic language the gracious offer by God and his willingness to overcome the abounding sin. It's as though God's grace is a giant blotter which is capable of absorbing all the stains and the grime of sin which had tarnished the nation of Israel and dragged them down into a state of gross apostasy. Now, of these three figures, the first one is the figure of marriage, which we've touched on in several occasions already. Look at chapter 2, where the first figure to illustrate God's love and grace is brought forward. We look at Hosea, chapter 2. An eye on the margin alternatives will be very helpful in appreciating the force of the original here. Hosea, chapter 2. We look at verse 1. The emotion comes through these words. Say unto your brethren, Ami, and to your sisters, Ruhama, plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight, and her adulteries from between her breasts. Notice the pleading. The emotion is packed in there behind the Lord's appeal through the prophet. But God's offer of forgiveness has conditions. They have to, in verse 2, do something themselves in order to appreciate and receive the benefits of God's grace. And we go further to verse 14. Speaking of the future, the gracious offer of the Lord. Therefore, behold, I, God, will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. That's a very important word. In Isaiah chapter 40, which marks a kind of watershed in the prophecy of Isaiah, the prophet begins by saying, comfort ye, comfort ye my people. And yet as we go through the prophecy, we can see they are still in need of forgiveness. Isaiah is saying that in his ministry. Hosea, as a contemporary, is also saying it, speaking of the future. Now, notice your margin, if you have one in the middle. Hebrew, to her heart. Now, literally, it means that God is speaking to her heart. That's the correct translation of speaking comfortably unto her. God appeals to the heart of his bride, because God, as the husband, is pained at his heart for her apostasy and her tokens of disloyalty. I will allure her, he says, and appeal to her heart. And the word to allure means, basically from the Hebrew, to woo. And in the New English Bible, it is translated exactly that way from the original. The New English renders that, I will woo her and speak comfortably unto her, or I will appeal to her heart. Now notice how this is an example, an approach for all of us as we make our appeals to the erring members of our own flock. Perhaps we ourselves will need that approach if and when we slip sometime. We don't see here in the prophet's tone, speaking on God's behalf, the grating, irritated voice of displeasure. This is not the displeased voice of an irate husband after having a domestic spat with his wife. I will woo her. I will speak to her heart. I will speak comfortably. A jealous husband? Yes, he was. Ill-tempered, nitpicking, insulting, impatient in his approach? God is not. Does God beg Israel? He does. Did Paul beg the flock in his epistles in the New Testament when he was aware of waywardness in the first century ecclesias? He did. And what was the New Testament word that Paul used that imitates this wooing or this alluring and speaking comfortably in Hosea? Well, the New Testament word used in Paul's epistles is the word beseech. And in the original, it comes very close to representing the idea of wooing and speaking to someone's heart comfortably. He uses the word beseech in his epistle to the Romans. I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God. He uses it again to the Corinthians. He uses it again in his epistle to the Galatians. Again in the Ephesians, the Philippians, the letter to the Thessalonians, the letter to Philemon, the letter to the Hebrews, the epistles of Peter, and John's epistles. It is an earmark of the apostle's gracious call in his writing to the flock in the first century. All of those ecclesias needed to be begged or beseeched. And the apostle did not see that posture to be demeaning to him as their superior. Nor does God, the Almighty of all creation, regarded as demeaning to his character to woo his bride and to go out and look for her and bring her back as the father did in the parable of the prodigal son. That is not demeaning to the Almighty. Chapter 3 of Hosea. We're going to touch on this in some detail tomorrow and analyze chapter 3 in greater detail. But just notice the essence of the appeal. Chapter 3, verse 1. Then said the Lord unto me, go yet, love a woman, beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord. That's what it's patterned after. According to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love flagons of wine. Does he still love the wayward sheep? Does he still have a gracious concern for their salvation? Or has he now, on the brink of their destruction, within only a few years of Assyria's coming down and taking a Samaria in 721, on the eve of all that, does God still have a genuine love for his bride, howbeit very wayward? Yes, he does. It shows the extent of God's patience in working with a wayward woman. How many hundreds of years have passed until the time of Hosea? How many prophets have come and gone, risen up early, and appealed to Israel? How many times have their appeal been spurned? Many times. Many, many years. In fact, many centuries have passed. God's patience. It doesn't last forever, but it is exceedingly long. And is certainly a pattern for all saints in their behavior with one another. God had patience over hundreds of years with his people. How many times should we be willing to forgive and be patient? Said Peter. 7 times? No. 70 times 7. And lest we think that that's a hyperbole or an exaggeration, look at God's appeal to Hosea and ask yourself, how long has it been that he's been begging or beseeching Israel? Many years. God's behavior here was certainly effective, and his actions with Israel were immediate. But his first immediate action with Israel was not to cut her off. It was to heal and to bring back. We often hear when we're dealing with ecclesial problems the call for swift, immediate, decisive action. And that, in a certain sense, is valid. There must be swift and immediate and decisive action. But is that a reflex to cutting off, or is that a reflex to appeal and to work with and be patient with the erring party? Let's take the example in Hosea of the Almighty God. We see here, as we go through, that God seems to be pained at his very heart as he pleads, as Paul pleaded. When he besought those ecclesias, he describes himself as being often in tears, the care of all the churches being upon him, as the care of Israel was upon God and the prophet. Slip back to Isaiah, a contemporary, who is making the same point at the same time as Hosea. And notice the beauty of this revelation and how it relates to Hosea's appeal. Isaiah 63. We're going to take 2 or 3 samples here from the prophets, somewhat contemporary with Isaiah and Hosea. Our first, Isaiah chapter 63. And we're going to look at verse 9. Again, this is retrospective, looking back down through the years as Hosea was, speaking to the same class, same time as Hosea. And God reminds them what he is reminding them through Hosea. Verse 9 of Isaiah 63. In all their affliction, he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his pity, he redeemed them, and he bare them, and carried them all the days of old. Were they wayward in the past? Were they a perfect nation when they came through the waters of the Red Sea? Did they try God's patience immeasurably? Yes, some 10 times, we're told in Numbers. You have tempted me in the wilderness. Indeed, God's patience finally came to a terminus, to an end. But all during that period, the example through Isaiah is that of patience. And see in verse 9 the extent to which God's heart was pained at what he saw in his people. In all their affliction, God was afflicted. Do we, in our prayers, when we consider the pain and the distress, whether physical or whether emotional, that we are going through, do we appreciate the extent to which God is agonizing with us? Isn't that the point in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, where he says, one member is not isolated from the other members? All the members of the Christ body are knit together, they sympathize and empathize with each other. They are knit together as David was in his soul with Jonathan. And that means empathy with each other. Sympathy for each other's cares and for each other's joys. If one member suffers, all the member suffer. Paul was told on the road to Damascus that his persecution of the saints was a persecution of Christ. And that what he was doing to the saints, he was doing to Christ. Paul personally went through an experience that helped him to understand what he wrote to the Corinthians in chapter 12 when he reminds them of the sympathy and empathy amongst the members of the body of Christ. That's what Paul learned on the Damascus road. And if Christ is affected, then certainly God is affected, whom he represents. In all their afflictions, he was afflicted. In his presence, he saved them. He loved them. He pitied them. And he redeemed them. And like a loving parent, he bore them and carried them all the days of old. Patience and mercy and sympathy in the midst of his people's trials. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 3. The examples really intensify as we get into Jeremiah, become even more graphic than what we see there in Isaiah 63. So we turn to Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 10. Now this paves a kind of introduction for a statement he's going to make in chapter 4. Notice how he zeroes in on the heart of the people first. He has described them in verse 9 as being whores and adulterers. Verse 10 of Jeremiah 3. And yet for all this, her treacherous sister Judah hath not turned unto me with her whole heart, but feignedly, saith the Lord. First, God focuses on the heart of Judah and shows how fickle it is, how inconsistent, how hypocritical they really are in their worship of God. They've turned to me, but hypocritically, feignedly, with their lips, but not with their heart. Now, it's the theme of the heart of the people and the heart of God that also runs through Hosea. God's heart and the people's heart. Now chapter 4 of Jeremiah, and we look at verse 19. And this is not the prophet speaking. The context shows this is God speaking of himself through the prophet. My bowels, verse 19, my bowels, I am pained at my very heart. My heart maketh a noise in me. I cannot hold my peace, because thou hast heard, O my soul, the sound of the trumpet, the alarm of war. Destruction upon destruction is cried, for the whole land is spoiled. Suddenly are my tents spoiled, and my curtains in a moment. How long shall I see the standard, and hear the sound of the trumpet? For my people is foolish. They have not known me. So the subject, the my of verse 19 is the my of verse 22. For my people is foolish. They have not known me. They are sottish children, and they have none understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. Now in verse 19, that is God describing himself. In all of his their afflictions, God is afflicted. My bowels, I am pained at my very heart. Do we believe that? Do we really consider the extent to which God claims to be affected by our trials and distress? How much does he enter into the distress of his people? That was the point with Hosea. That was the very reason for Hosea personally experiencing an unfaithful wife, so that his heart might be pained and in a small way, more keenly appreciate the heart of the Almighty he was representing. Now Jeremiah 23, verse 9. Jeremiah 23, verse 9. mine heart within me is broken. Because of the prophets, all my bones shake. I am like a drunken man, like a man whom wine hath overcome because of the Lord, and because of the words of his holiness. For the land is full of adulterers, for because of swearing the land mourneth. The pleasant places of the wilderness are dried up, and their course is evil, and their force is not right. Here's the prophet speaking. But what he says in chapter 23 about his heart is his ability, in a small way, to identify with the heart of God. In other words, what is said in chapter 2 and chapter 4 links now with chapter 23. Their heart is feigned, it's hypocritical. But God's heart is genuine, and God, as it were, is pained in his very heart at the sins of the people. And now the prophet begins, on God's behalf, to empathize with that sentiment, and he is now beginning to feel the pain in his heart. So with Jeremiah, so with Hosea. When we see in John 15, the Lord standing at the tomb of Lazarus, and in those short words, Jesus wept. Are we at that point getting a revelation of God? Jesus was the Word made flesh. He that seeth me seeth the Father. Was there any emotional response from the Master that did not in some way reflect the emotions, the feelings of the Master himself, of the true Lord? Was there anything that Jesus said or did that did not reflect the Father? Absolutely none. When the Lord then breaks down and weeps at the tomb of Lazarus, we see a reflection of what is revealed to us in Hosea about God, what is revealed to us in Isaiah 63, and what is revealed here in these statements from Jeremiah. If Jesus wept, for whatever reason, it was care for his people, a response to what was going on at the time. It reflects the Father to us, who also is pained and, figuratively speaking, weeps at the wayward. We return to Hosea. Chapter 11. We see perhaps why Jesus, on two occasions at least, directed his readers to Hosea in the Gospels. Go back and read what it meaneth, he said. I will have mercy and not sacrifice. For in Hosea, we see one of the most beautiful expositions of mercy. Jesus said, go back and read Hosea. You have failed to see the point. Well, let's look at another point in this regard, chapter 11 of Hosea, from which we get our title today. When Israel was a child, verse 1, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. Verse 2, as they called them, so they went from them. They sacrificed unto Balaam and burned incense to graven images. And the sense here is obviously, as they called them, so they went from them. The more God appealed to them, the further away they went. And the New International Version in verse 2 translates that, the more I called to Israel, the further they went from me. Like the picture we often see in the supermarket, where a child runs away from the clutches of his mother. And the more the mother runs after the child, the further the child moves down the aisle and finally disappears in the crowd. And the more the mother calls, the further and faster the child runs. I've had that many times. That's exactly what's going on here in a very human way. The more God appeals, the closer he tries to approach to Israel, the further the wayward son goes beyond God's grasp. Verse 3. I taught Ephraim also to go. That means literally, I taught also Ephraim to walk. Taking them by their arms. This is God. But they knew not that I healed them. And the original in the AV here, for the AV, is that God taught them how to walk, taking them by the arms as a parent does the child. And the picture in the original Hebrew is that of a man or a parent standing with legs straddling the child
behind the child, hands underneath the armpits or holding onto the fingers, and as the child moves, the parent walks behind. It's a typical scene. We've been in the living room before, perhaps, ourselves, and seen ourselves encouraging the young children to walk. We hold the hands, or we put our hands under the armpits, and as the child stumbles along, we stumble along, and ah, yes, the child's taken its first step.
Really, it's been the help of us. That's God in picture here. He sees himself as a parent, as it were, standing over the child Israel. And he says, I taught you how to walk. I've straddled with you. I've held your arms. I've given you your first steps. How can you turn back on me as your loving parent? Thus we are now into the second image, from that of marriage to that of parenthood in chapter 11. The second image used in the prophet to illustrate the tender mercies of God and his willingness to forgive. Go back to your infancy. Consider what I was like as a parent. Was I not tender to you? Didn't I help you make your very first steps? Didn't I hold you by the arms and straddle with you and try to help you to stand on your own and to help you be independent? Am I a loving parent or am I not? Of course God was. The imagery continues with the parent. Verse 4. I drew them with cords of a man, with bands of love, and I was to them as they that take off the yoke on their jaws, and I laid meat unto them. The expression, I laid meat unto them, is originally in the original, the idea of bending down to feed. And thus, the New International and other versions translate that phrase, did I not bend down to feed them? Now, you could see here the example, for example, of feeding an animal. But in the context, it's most likely that of a parent feeding a child. The one who is doing the feeding is the provider. The one receiving it needs nourishment and help from the giver. And God is saying to Israel, haven't I bent down, as it were, and offered food to you? Haven't I put the spoon in your mouth from the time of infancy? Haven't I fed you before you were independent and able to feed yourself? What an amazing picture. A cameo of parent and child. From the early days of first walking and being fed. And the stress is, have I not, God, bent down and fed you? What a condescending God the Israel of God worships. That he will actually bend down. Was Jesus illustrating that in John 13 in the upper room? Was there any significance in the fact that to wash their feet, the Lord had to bend down? Isn't God saying that that's what he has done already in the past? Isaiah told us that he bore them all the days of old, stooped down, picked them up, took them and placed them on his shoulders or carried them in his arms. But he bent down and took them, scooped them in his arms and his embrace. A loving picture here, brothers and sisters. What does it say to us about our appeal to the wayward, to those who are in need of succor and help in the ecclesia or in our own family? We need, as Jesus did, and as he reflected what God is saying in Hosea, to bend down in front of our brothers and sisters. I have given you a pattern, says Jesus in John 13, that if I have done, so you must do. You must bend down and you must be willing to wash the feet of the saints. You must be like a parent, as Paul was. You must be willing to bend down and to help your disciples walk. The brothers and the sisters, young or old, that need assistance. The bending down in our ecclesial activities to help the wayward, the weak, the young and the truth to stagger and take the first steps. Love, patience, time, repeated action. The willingness to feed those that are young in the flock, to put the spoon in their mouth, as it were, at first, before they are independent and can feed on the meat of the word. The willingness, brothers and sisters, to stoop down as God has condescended to us. Does that typify our approach to our fellow disciples? Or rather, is it force-feeding? Is it instead an irritated, scolding voice that says, "Weak brother or sister, stand up and walk. We've been working with you now for 3 weeks, 2 months, a year, and you still aren't independent. You still can't feed yourself spiritually. You are still not walking on your own. How much longer do we have to bear with you?" How long did God bear with Israel? How long does Christ bear with us? Now we continue in the same chapter. Because the picture intensifies and becomes even more emotional. Verse 7, the stubbornness of the nation is insinuated. Verse 7, "And my people are bent to backsliding from me." Look at the inclination of the nation. Bent to backsliding, though they called them to the Most High, none at all would exalt him. Now verse 8. "How shall I give thee up, Ephraim? How shall I deliver thee, Israel? How shall I make thee as Admah? How shall I set thee as Zeboim? Mine heart is turned within me. My repentings are kindled together." That's God. That was Jeremiah. That was also God in Jeremiah when he talked about his bowels being pained within him. That was Isaiah speaking on God's behalf. In all their afflictions, he was afflicted. That's the husband in Hosea 2, verse 1. "Plead with your mother, plead, for I'm not her husband. My heart is turned within me." Now, all of those descriptions are very important. First, who or what was Admah? What was Zeboim? Where's the historical background to that? It's most illuminating. Go to Genesis 19, if you will. And let's catch the background here. Genesis chapter 19 speaks of the destruction of Sodom. Are those cities familiar to you? The cities of the Salt Plain? Genesis chapter 19. Verse 21 first. "And he said unto him, See, I have accepted thee concerning this thing also, that I will not overthrow this city for which thou hast spoken." And we go down to verse 29. "It came to pass when God destroyed the cities," plural, not just Sodom and Gomorrah, "of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in the which Lot dwelt." Now, we know that the cities of the plain in chapter 14 of Genesis and verse 8 included the cities of Admah and Zeboim. And if we're not too sure of that, again, Deuteronomy 29 as a further proof, apart from Genesis 14 and 8. Instead, we'll go Deuteronomy 29, where the account is given for us in more detail than Genesis. Deuteronomy 29, verse 23. "And that the whole land thereof is brimstone and salt and burning, that it is not sown, nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath." Now, what's that got to do with God's heart? Hosea chapter 11. Let's look at it again. Verse 8. "How shall I give thee up, Ephraim? How shall I deliver thee, Israel? How shall I make thee as Admah? How shall I set thee as Zeboim? Mine heart is turned within me." Now, significantly, apart from now knowing what these cities refer to in Israel's past, And the rhetorical question posed by God, shall I make you like I made Sodom? And by the way, there's an analogy, comparison there. Obviously, he's saying that Israel now, in Hosea's time, is ripe for punishment, just as much as the cities of Adma and Zeboim on the Salt Plain. So they couldn't help but miss the degradation to which they had reached in this comparison. But of greater significance, my heart is turned within me, and the Hebrew word there for turned is the same word in Genesis 19 for the overthrowing of the cities on the Salt Plain. The Hebrew word haphak, H-A-P-H-A-K, is the way it's usually spelt, is the word describing the overturning over the overthrowing of the cities on the Salt Plain. In other words, using the same imagery of the case with Sodom and Gomorrah, Adma and Zeboim, he is saying, will I throw them, Israel, upside down? Will I turn them over like I did with Sodom and Gomorrah? Because they are like Sodom and Gomorrah. And my heart is upside down. It is in turmoil. My heart, God, is in turmoil like the cities of the Salt Plain when I finished punishing them. The chaos, the turmoil, the emotion in the midst of the flames as those cities were finally destroyed is graphically now portraying God's heart in turmoil. And he says, my repentings are kindled together. And the word repentings in Hebrew means, from the Hebrew word nakam, to sigh or to breathe strongly. The whole description just breathes with God's emotion and the depth of his feeling. His heart, like the cities of Sodom, is overturned. It's in a chaotic condition. It is marked by repentings or breathings or sighings that are deep and strong. And he says, my sighings or my breathings, repentings in the AV, are kindled within me. And Rotherham translates that, my breathings or sighings are glowing as to glow hot as a rod that has been heated in the fire. My heart is glowing with emotion. So when he says in chapter 2, verse 1, plead with your mother, plead, that is not, brothers and sisters, a dispassionate appeal. When God speaks through Hosea, he is speaking with deep emotion. And as he sees his people apostate like Sodom and Gomorrah, he sees his heart like at Sodom, overthrown and overturned. What can he possibly do with this recalcitrant people? They are so incorrigible, they will not respond to his appeal. Like yesterday, they are like a piece of dough left on the oven all night. It is hard and charred, like a silly dove, fickle and lacking any sense, jumping from branch to branch. Like a bowl that is deceitful, he said yesterday. All of those graphic descriptions of their apostasy has made them stubborn. And God is saying, please consider your position, as Paul did. Please consider the extent to which I care for you. Consider my heart and take a heart by example to yourself. Chapter 6 provides our concluding allusion in order to describe God's intense care for his people as their husband. First, the figure of marriage. Second, the figure of the parent who straddles with the child, teaches it to walk, and feeds it. A child who has been recalcitrant and stubborn in its ways in its early training. And now the great physician, the figure of healing. Chapter 6, verse 1. Come, and let us return unto the Lord, for he hath torn, and he will heal us. He hath smitten, and he will bind us up. Chapter 7, verse 1. When I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was discovered. Healing, healing. Chapter 14. of Hosea. Verse 2. Take with you words and turn to the Lord. Say unto him, take away all iniquity and receive us graciously. Receive us graciously. So will we render the calves of our lips. And then down to verse 4. I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely. For my anger is turned away from him. Jesus, the great physician, and all that he did to cure the blind, to give sight to those who were in darkness, to bind up the brokenhearted, says Isaiah, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, to give beauty for ashes and the oil of joy for mourning. I love the sinner, says God. Therefore you must love your wife, Hosea. I pity the wayward. You must pity your wife who has betrayed you. I forgive the disobedient, Hosea. You must forgive your wife who has disobeyed you. I have compassion on the weak and the wayward and the sinner. You, Hosea, must forgive and bind up.